The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com.
Today is Wednesday. It's 9/11/2024. It's also 2:40 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams, and we are the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and Ironlight, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way.
What's up, guys? Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on WCIU, and contributor to many other platforms.
I'm Eric Zorn. I'm the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly Substack newsletter. I am planning tomorrow's episode, but I am just right now have concepts of a plan for the issue.
And I am Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now doing the Chicago History Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972. Wearing the same earrings as a certain someone was last night, which I wear every day, although you guys probably don't notice it. But
those are the Kamala Harris earrings you're talking about?
That was my favorite part. I was like, there's my earrings.
So are those the same ones then that they were feeding audio instructions to her so as to better her answers? Because the first text I got this morning was, you could tell they were feeding her information. That's why she did so well. And I said, look, I've got more issues on my plate here, including migrants that are trying to get arrested so they can get transgender surgery. I don't have time to sort of whack every mole that pops up. So
I have mine tuned to just feed me jokes from your show.
Thank you. Thank you. We do speed jokes. I have none for us here, though. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris debated last night for 90 minutes on a variety of topics, including the economy, abortion, immigration, and the problem of Haitian migrants eating people's pets in Ohio. As the dust settles on these sorts of things, it is not uncommon to then ask who won the debate. And to be honest with you, I'm not too concerned about what other people say about that, even what a credible poll might say about that. If the purpose of a debate is to persuade someone to win the argument, then in this case, we will know who won in November. That's the only important answer to what transpired last night. It will come in November. But I will say this, Kamala Harris did as well as Joe Biden did badly in the first debate. It was a favorable format and room for her. I've caught some flack about that today. But her body and verbal language were really good. She was well rehearsed. And when questions came up for which she did not have a good answer, she did what they all do. She didn't answer them. I guess for all of us, there's a number of ways to go forward now. Like, did you have a laugh out loud or an oh my God moment that just happened? They said that.
Laugh out loud wasn't they're killing the pets. It was actually an undercover discussed line. And I can't even remember what he was talking about, but he had a quick aside while he was talking that exemplified Trump's entire mentality during the debate. Is he's going through a line and he pauses and he says, I guess I'm saying that, or I guess I just said that, or something like that. He was like retelling what he just said, and he was like, I guess I'm saying that.
Yeah, okay.
He was all over the place in terms of his messaging. He could not stick to key themes. His closing statement was his strongest statement of the entire night and should have been what he was talking about the entire time, which is, why haven't you fixed it? You're in office. Why haven't you fixed it? It was almost as though he remembered what his key talking point should have been at the very end of the debate. So he was completely thrown off his game. Kamala smartly brought up crowd size, to which he had to respond because he has a big ego about that. So I think in all, incredible missed opportunity for Trump. I don't think anyone who supports Trump could call that anything else than a disappointing or even bad debate for him. That said, during the 2016 campaign, I think you could easily say that Hillary Clinton won all of those debates and it didn't quite matter. Now, this is a little different because the country's still getting to know Kamala Harris, so maybe that changes things. But that did not matter in 2016.
I mean, there was a lot of standout moments. I think Kamala Harris came in and did an outstanding job. I think there's no question. We want to pick winners and losers of the debate. she won the debate. As Austin says, though, winning a debate doesn't win you the election. But things that stood out to me immediately when she said 81 million people fired you and clearly you're having a tough time processing that. There are these moments where she made these attack lines hitting his vulnerabilities and things that really get under his skin, where you would think it'd be easy for him at this point with situational awareness to just not let it get under your skin. And he couldn't not take the bait. And the best and most effective part is she talked directly to him, or she's calling him weak, words he loves to use, talking about the impact of overturning Roe versus Wade. She spoke directly to him, whereas most of the time during the debate, Donald Trump kept his eyes fixed forward on the moderators or looking down, shaking his head. Kamala Harris did both a great job of addressing Donald Trump directly, owning the debate stage on her terms, even from the jump, going right up to him, shaking his hand, gaining control of the room right away. I think it was a fantastic display, an unsurprising one if you understand who Kamala Harris is, a prosecutor versus a convicted felon. She even said it right away. This is rich coming from someone who's been convicted for a litany of crimes. I even think on the policy front, she got across clear policies that she's selling for the American people. And I do think that she often is judged on a different plane or different rules than Donald Trump is. We demand policy out of Kamala Harris. There's never any policy out of Donald Trump. Overall, I think it was a blowout. I think if we want to compare Trump to a football team, he's had a terrible strength of schedule these past few debates. He just faced the toughest opponent yet, and he got blown out.
He was Michigan to Kamala Harris's Texas, if I may use that college football. A painful college football metaphor. I alluded earlier to the concepts of a plan line that he had where he was asked about his promises really since 2015 that he's going to have a replacement for Obamacare, that he's figured out a way to provide health care coverage to people, low-income people especially, that's better than Obamacare. And there's some great rundowns online of all the times that he said, it's coming in about 2 months, I've got a plan coming, it's going to happen. And he's never been able to articulate what that plan is. And here he is running for president again, and he has no plan for healthcare. He has concepts of a plan, which is he wants something better than Obamacare, but he doesn't know what that looks like, which is, you know, it's a counter to what I mean. Austin was alluding to Trump's closing statement, which he should have been hammering on. He said that, you know, well, you've had 3.5 years to do this, these things that you're talking about. Why haven't you done it? Well, the first answer is like, because I'm the vice president. Have you ever watched Veep? You know, I'm sitting in my office waiting to see if POTUS is called. But the other thing is to say, well, you had 4 years as president. You never got Mexico to pay for your stupid wall. You never put a program together to provide health care. There are all kinds of things that Trump has promised. We know what kind of president Trump was. This is not just a challenger running against an incumbent. This is essentially two incumbents, I guess, if you look at it that way. One observation that I have, or a couple of them. One is that I have, from tomorrow's newsletter, I'm going through and I'm counting the number of times that he refers to what everybody knows. He talks about, you know, everybody knows Kamala Harris is a Marxist. I've been a leader on support for IVF. Everybody knows it. Everybody's laughing at Kamala Harris. And then also nobody gets a lot of shout outs where he says, like, crime is as high as levels nobody ever thought possible. And the energy record. I got oil business going like nobody's ever done it before. He's got this reflexive tendency to grossly exaggerate. He talks about how everybody wanted Roe v. Wade overturned. Well, that's just completely false. Like 2/3 of the public supported Roe v. Wade in just about every poll I've ever seen. And so he's just lying about that stuff. But the one thing I'm circling around to here is I thought the one place where I was disappointed in Harris's performance was the number of times that Trump talked about what a hellhole the United States is, how terrible the country is doing, what an awful place it is. That's just false. I mean, we have, you know, our inflation spiked, but it's now at 2.5%, which is just a shade over the target. The unemployment rate is 4.2% now. It's down from 6.4 when Trump left office. The markets are way up. The Dow is now at 40,000. It was at 30,000 or so when Trump left. The NASDAQ is at 17 when it was at 13 under Trump. The S&P is at 5,500. It was 3,800 under Trump. I mean, the fact that he keeps saying crime is down, of course, too, and the NATO alliance is stronger. There's all kinds of ways in which the United States is kind of a model country. We got problems for sure. Mm-hmm. But for him to say that this country is awful is just not true. And I wish that she had said that. I thought that was a real missed opportunity on her part. But otherwise, I would agree with the room that she opened a can of whoop-ass on him.
I agree with that. She started out incredibly strong, wearing the right earrings, shaking hands with him when he didn't expect it. That was all amazing. I'm sure, like a lot of people, I was nervous about her performance going into it. She was not a great campaigner in 2019. I cannot stop thinking about her horrible, just really awful interview with Lester Holt.
Yeah.
And then the CNN interview with Anna Bash was also just not impressive. Softball questions, and she was not really that on top of it. So I was nervous going into it. She's a former prosecutor. She should be amazing, but she hasn't been impressing me. So all of those things, I was expecting, you know, possibly not a lot, and she really brought it. That was great. So I agree she commanded the room, but the problem is, who was in the room? Her, Donald Trump, and two anchor people who we know are going to vote for Kamala Harris. The only important question is how this went over with the swing voters, especially the swing voters in Pennsylvania. Let's all face it. Like, only those people matter. Only those swing voters in Pennsylvania practically are the people who matter. And I really don't know, as time goes on, how she did with them. That's very unclear to me because, you know, that Time Siena poll that came out on Monday had a lot of really interesting information on it. And it showed 90% of the likely voters said that they really knew Trump. And it was only 28% who felt that they knew Kamala Harris. And at the same time, 60% said the country's going in the wrong direction. Only 30% said they thought we were on the right track. 35% said they thought Harris represented change. 55% said Trump represented change. So these voters want change. And right now, they don't think she represents change. I don't think that she did what she needed to do last night in terms of differentiating herself from Biden and showing moderation of her previous views that are documented as being far more progressive than certainly those swing voters in Pennsylvania. That's what she needs to do.
Were you all bothered by the number of questions that she didn't answer? There was one question that was posed to her, which was three parts, and she said, I'll get to all of that. It was the one that included fracking, and she never circled back to that and had no intention of doing that. I also thought the question of many Americans don't feel they're better off now than they were 4 years ago, that age-old economics question. And then she started to talk about her middle-class upbringing and the woman that was her second mom was a small business person. So I'm like, oh, Jesus, just answer the question. And I don't think there's a wrong answer to that if you're clear. You could have said, yeah, a lot of people still haven't caught up with the rest of us and we need to work on that. Or no, do the stuff Eric said and said, the truth is we as a nation are better. Austin, the dodges were frustrating to me.
The one that I was thinking of was, have you met Vladimir Putin? That was left unanswered. And I think there are conservatives who are up in arms about, you know, the moderators were biased. They pushed back more against Trump than Kamala. They definitely did push back more against Trump than Kamala. But Trump lost the debate. Trump could have easily, at several points throughout the debate, asked her a question directly. I think he used that tactic one time.
It was against the rules.
It was about abortion. And I think he said, well, what do you think, 7th, 8th, 9th month? And
right.
She didn't answer that. He could have done that with any number of questions that the moderators asked and didn't. He was totally just off message, didn't seem dialed in at all, very scattered all over the place. So like the conservatives blaming the moderators is just sort of like, you know, they're working the refs.
Yeah, as someone said, you can't blame the refs when you're missing all your shots. And it is true that they did challenge him on his factual assertions more than they challenged Harris, but he was lying more than she was. I mean, and she didn't always tell the truth, but the CNN count was like 33-1 or something. Mm-hmm. It was pretty astounding. They did let Trump talk more. And if people are complaining that they cut him off or didn't let him have his piece, they let him talk. They let him talk more than they should have. He would jump in. They would try to start a new question. They would just jump in and say no. They would say yes, go ahead and respond to that. And so you ended up with I think he had like 41 minutes to 37 minutes of talking time. I don't know what the word count is, but he was allowed to say what he wanted to say. And the fact that he was lying about it, conservatives can't complain about that. I mean, he was lying. There was just no question about it.
Yeah, I think what Kamala Harris was trying to do, and it's tough to do in one debate, was both introduce those who don't know her to who she is, while also trying to offer what she calls the opportunity agenda and, you know, her policies for the future and project that she is the candidate for the future, a new generation of leadership. I think mission accomplished on that end. I do think that there needs to be more done by the Harris campaign to get more people who say they don't know who she is to get those numbers up. I think the easiest way to do that is to do more media. I think it's still a mistake that she's completely kind of abandoned traditional media. And I say that because I don't see them utilizing digital media the way I thought they would do if they're going to opt for that instead of media. You know what I'm saying? Like, slam dunk opportunities I haven't seen them do yet that I think maybe they will be doing. Maybe, who knows, it may come out tomorrow. I saw she just did the Ricky Smiley morning show, so that's one. She should be on The Breakfast Club. She should be on Morning Joe. She should be, if she wants to avoid traditional media, then do what Trump does. Go to your friendly zones. Trump is on Fox and Friends. He's on Hannity. He's getting the exposure he wants to the people. I don't think a 60 minutes interview would hurt, actually. And that goes to a wide audience. She needs to do things like that because the bottom line is, while she may not want traditional media, for many people, that's how they're going to get to know her. It's not going to be a podcast interview. It's not going to be a radio interview. It's going to be, 60 minutes is on after the Packers versus the Lions. Great. I'll sit and watch that. So I think she's got to do a better job with her campaign of utilizing these opportunities to get her name, her message out there more.
Yeah, I was also disappointed by her lack of coherent response to why she changed her positions. I asked her about why she was opposed to fracking in 2019 when she was running for president, and her answer is, I've been in favor of fracking since 2020. I haven't changed my position. Well, in 2020, she was then Joe Biden's running mate, and she was adopting Joe Biden's policies and principles. She was standing by him. It doesn't explain at all whether she has had her own change of heart about this, and if she has, why. It's not a sin or a crime to change your mind about an issue, but it is, I think, very disquieting to have a politician not be able to explain, other than just pure expediency. I think we probably know why she's in favor of fracking now. It's just she knows that there are a lot of pro-fracking votes in Pennsylvania, and you'd be it's kind of like the way Barack Obama was opposed to gay marriage, or he said he was opposed to gay marriage in the middle part of his career, his national political career, because he thought it wouldn't play well, when in fact he had said in the 90s that he was in favor of gay marriage, and then as soon as Joe Biden pushed him out, he then became in favor of it. It's like these politicians have their fingers to the wind, and they don't know how to talk about that. They don't know how to admit it.
Boy, sitting here in Illinois, I just keep thinking, I can't believe we're talking about fracking. I don't give a fig about fracking. I'm not even sure what fracking is. I know what fracking is, but don't ask.
Pennsylvania.
I know it, but you're right, Kate. It's like you said, we're all watching a show for Pennsylvania. The whole world is watching a show about Pennsylvania.
Easy for me to keep it in mind because in 2016 was one of the many years in which my husband and I were driving my kids back and forth, both of them, to New York for school, dropping them off in September, picking them up in the spring, going on 80, back and forth. I can't tell you how much time I spent in Pennsylvania. Beautiful country.
That state does go on forever, though, doesn't it?
And that one year, we actually got a flat tire and spent quite a bit of time really with the people of Pennsylvania, with the tow truck driver, with all the people all the way through that. And It was the first time we saw Trump signs. There were no Trump signs here when we left. It was just such a visceral symbol to me. They are an extremely different audience from we here. And as it turns out, unfortunately, a far more important audience right now.
I think we got to be fair here. She did address the fracking during this debate. She thinks it's good to look at different sources of energy, invest in diverse sources, reduce her reliance on foreign oil. But ultimately, and this is the problem she has inherently, I don't know how to fix it, Kamala Harris is held to a different standard than Donald Trump, and it is unfair. Donald Trump has changed positions on 20, 30 different things throughout his whole career. The guy used to be a Democrat. Yeah, I don't hear the same energy about he needs to explain this or that. I will give the ABC moderators credit, though. They made sure to stick with one of his big flip-flops, which was on abortion. He changed his position on abortion 4 different times in a month.
Everyone's pointing out the fact that Trump was clearly not very well prepared, which, of course, he wasn't. But we don't expect that of him. He, as you say, Brandon, has very different expectations upon him. There's no doubt about that. But importantly, she was very well prepared. And yet, that was the one thing that she was not prepared to do, clearly, or she would have done it. She did not want to explain her changes in policy. She really managed to kind of smooth over that fracking thing. She didn't even really explain her change on fracking, much less much more difficult subjects like the border. And there is no, as you were saying, Eric, there is no shame in saying I changed my mind. That Time Siena poll showed that only 32% of voters think Trump is too conservative, but 47% think she is too liberal. So she really needs to talk about her changes of heart on some of those topics.
Yeah, I sort of wonder whether they're changes of heart or whether she basically has always been sort of a moderate Democrat, and she went hard left during the campaign in 2019.
Who knows? It doesn't really matter as long as she explains the change so that people who are not that progressive, i.e. Pennsylvania swing state voters, will feel that she's not lying about her positions now.
So I guess my question then would be, how many times do we need her to explain it? Because in the CNN interview with Dana Bash, she gave a pretty good explanation. She said, my values have changed.
My values have not changed.
Your values have not changed. Yeah.
Yeah. She did not give a good explanation. She didn't explain why her policy changed. She just said that her values hadn't changed.
Go ahead, Brandon.
She also says she's been vice president and had a chance to talk to people around the country, and it's about building consensus. I think those are good reasons. I think the strategy from the campaign, though, was drawing contrasts. And in terms of drawing contrasts, she passed the test. Now, in a second debate, if they have one, can she maybe go deeper into here's why I changed policy X or Y? Sure.
She walked off that stage and said, let's have another debate. Should there be another debate? He's the one that walked into the spin room afterwards. He's the one that went up to the reporters and tried to massage what just happened. She so clearly knocked him out that I think he has a lot more to gain than she does in a second debate.
The Harris campaign feels very confident that there's more work to do. They understand one debate is not going to showcase everything they need to for this flash candidate. And I think they feel very confident that Kamala can hold her own against Donald Trump. Even whatever notes he takes or whatever changes, tweaks he makes, probably not a lot, they feel confident, hey, we can replay this.
Even if it's on Fox.
Yeah, I think it's confidence. I think it's a smart strategy. It also plays directly into Trump's macho, bravado ego that he tries to convey. And now he's trying to act like, well, I won the debate.
Austin, would you do another debate if you were Kamala Harris?
I don't know. I think I would probably lean into the strategy that Pope outlined, which is do far more friendly media where you're talking about yourself and your personal story to get your awareness up, and do non-traditional things, do podcasts, do YouTube series, do things like that, rather than going for the debate. But it would be very hard, I think, if you're her campaign, to say no to another chance to do what she did with Donald Trump yesterday night. So the question would be, it's always a game of expectations, right? So is she going to exceed expectations the next debate? Probably not. She'll probably meet expectations because she just raised the bar. Trump has nowhere, like the bar is on the floor for Trump. He had a terrible debate performance and would probably be better in a second debate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he would be better prepared. Yeah. He famously did not prepare for this, that he kind of goes on instinct and has a couple of chats with people, but he was clearly unprepared. His answers were rambling and he just decided he was going to hit inflation and immigration. And then he just kind of got carried away. This thing about migrants eating pets. It's just one of these crazy. I mean, if Kamala Harris had turned to him and said, like, well, yes, and your vice presidential candidate has sex with couches or something. I mean, it's like it's at that level of nonsense. She managed to restrain herself. There was one moment where she was talking about how he met with the Taliban, and she turned to him and said something like, kind of looked at him and said, and this, and you just knew that there were all kinds of.
Yes. I thought, what's the word? What's the word? What are you going to say?
She reined it in. But boy, I don't know. I've had that kind of self control myself. But.
Yeah, I wonder too if she had done that. Say she just unloaded some expletive or just called him a bleep bleep. If you would have been able to hear the cheers in the suburbs, or if that would have actually worked against her, because now she's in the mud with the pigs.
The only reason I would actually agree to a second debate at this point. The second debate needs to be the traditional town hall style standing.
No.
Why?
What's the upside to that? What possible good does that do?
The upside is the visual. Harris, a woman, small in stature. Donald Trump, a big, tall, imposing bully. That's, you're drawing even more contrast. An old bully. He showed his age. He's old. He's wearing down. He lost steam toward the end too.
You're getting greedy, Brandon. You won, and you won it in that room under those terms, and now you want another home run?
That debate, to me, you could have got another hour. I think there was, as we're saying now, she didn't get all her policy stuff out. She didn't get to talk about everything in detail.
Here's what I think Donald Trump could do, though. Lord knows. He's not disciplined. He doesn't listen to good advice. But my good advice to him would be the Donald Trump you were in the debate against Joe Biden. He was kind of presidential. He didn't go off the rails. He was reined in. Even if some of the stuff he said was nonsense, the way he delivered it was so much more collected than it was last night. If that Donald Trump comes back onto the debate stage, I think it eats away at that worry that this guy can't control himself.
I understand that, but look, he was facing Joe Biden, and Joe is not as quick. Joe isn't going to have the zingers.
I would first look at what the polls are showing, because you know we were all talking about what we wanted to hear from Kamala Harris, what we're missing, how we're feeling about her. But we're all kind of nerds on this panel here. There are a lot of people who are not paying a whole lot of attention, and when they're going to take these polls, they'll find out whether she made her mark, whether she got done what she needed to get done with these, you know, sort of low information voters, swing voters. If the polls show that her numbers are picked up here, then I think she should not take the risk of another debate, because Trump might prepare. He might be able to do better. People will talk about how he's so improved and how she didn't do one thing and another. I mean, we all have little criticisms of Harris from her performance last night. It does seem to me that I might just leave well enough alone. Now, she's already offered, right? She came off the stage to do this again, probably just on a complete high, right?
Yeah.
But which I get. I'm sure she's elated. Every demo, my phone was blowing up. But in the same way that my phone blew up during the Biden debate, when Biden was so awful with Democrats who were ready to jump off buildings. Last night, I was getting texted and message from friends and email and stuff like saying, like, oh, this is so great. I'm so excited. And she's killing him. She's kicking his butt. And this is really so if you have that response now and you got the enthusiasm ginned up, I don't know that there's any upside to the risk of another debate, because every debate's a risk, right?
Maybe her campaign immediately offered another debate on more pragmatic grounds, as opposed to just being on a big high from doing so well at the debate. Right now, the latest Nate Silver model gives her 48.9% over Trump at 46.6%. But that only gets her a 35.3% chance of winning the Electoral College. As a Democrat, she has to do much better than this very hotly contested 50-50 sort of race that they're doing.
Kate, was that pre-debate, that silver
analysis?
That
was on Monday. So we'll obviously see how things move. But unless she truly leaps ahead of him, she does still need to really bring it some more. She needs up to 4 points better than Trump to get to like an 84% chance of winning the Electoral College.
What do you all think?
Today, Silver's model has, this is after the debate, Trump's at 62% likelihood of winning Electoral College. Harris is at 38% likelihood to win the Electoral College. And the crazy thing to the discussion earlier is, according to that model and according to every political expert, if Kamala wins Pennsylvania, she has a 90% chance of winning the presidency. If Trump wins Pennsylvania, he has a 90% chance of winning the presidency. There's no other state that comes anywhere close to that in terms of the odds of turning for both candidates. And I don't know, maybe we should just not vote, and Pennsylvania could just decide the president forever. And it's kind of dispiriting, right? Like there's 10 to 20,000 people in Pennsylvania that will ultimately decide this, almost no matter what happens the rest of the way.
Just in case they're listening to us, Brandon, I'm going to back you up one more time on, she should totally go all out on the more digital things. I mean, she's going to obviously maybe not be picking up 60 Minutes and stuff, but she can get probably way, way more listeners and viewers doing, like, why doesn't she do Joe Rogan? Why doesn't she do Lex Friedman? They have millions of listeners, and these are both people who will just sit there and listen to her and let her talk.
Missed opportunity. I think that's a Democratic Party problem overall. They don't use their echo chambers as well as the right wing does.
Of course, the election isn't tomorrow. We're 50 some days out now. She wasn't a candidate a month ago. I wonder then, though, Austin, if she was going to try and solidify Pennsylvania, that those numbers you just mentioned are so disheartening. I'm surprised that the silver model is that extreme, you know, that
depended on Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
That's not just him, though. I mean, that's, you talk to anyone, if you win Pennsylvania, the path becomes very, very clear to the White House, and it's not that way.
Yeah, but I was hopeful that you could lose Pennsylvania, but still win Georgia and Arizona and Wisconsin and Michigan, and there's a path that way without Pennsylvania.
Well, part of it is there's so many states that always vote the same as Pennsylvania too. Pennsylvania's got this huge number of electoral votes, and then if Pennsylvania goes one way, you can pretty much figure that Michigan, Wisconsin are going to go that way, too.
So then what should she say, do or be in the interim then to shore that up?
Two things that I think are important potentially in Pennsylvania are, one, keep slamming Project 2025/abortion, because that works everywhere, but it will work in Pennsylvania. And then also, I think a very smart messaging tactic that works because people have very little economic knowledge, but this intuitively makes sense, and I happen to agree with it, is tariffs are sales tax. Trump wants a national sales tax. It's called a tariff. It's going to make everything go up in price by 20%. I think that's a really simple message, and I would focus heavily on those two things in states like Pennsylvania.
You noticed that when she brought that up last night, she didn't call it a tariff. She called it the Trump national sales tax. And I knew what she was doing, but I wondered if she skipped a step. And then the very favorable moderators helped her with that, saying, well, that's the Trump tariff, and they connected those things for us. If things are going to cost me $4,000 more, I think was the number she threw out there, a number that was generated by a liberal think tank, but even conservative ones say that a tariff would cost us more money.
Trump's response to it was a pretty good response, but he's explaining about it, so he's losing. His response was, I had a bunch of tariffs when I was in office, and you kept all of them. I mean, most of these tariffs are still there, which is a good response. The other weakness of that is, well, she's also proposing a lot of new taxes on businesses. And if you're going to argue that a tariff is a sales tax, because guess what? The cost gets passed on to the consumer. Same thing applies to hiking taxes on businesses. It gets passed on to the consumer. But I think her focus, like taking the high ground on the cost of living stuff by saying he's trying to pass a sales tax, is really smart.
Do you think that they should have pushed her on, pardon me, Brandon, let me ask this and then you can respond to any way you want, like they do on the debate. But should they have pushed her more because she said, I want to give new homeowners a head start, new businesses a head start? She was throwing out some serious coin for everybody out there. Nobody said, where's that going to come from? What a very liberal Democrat position to take. And I thought Trump, even if he didn't have to answer it, could have asked the question, how is she going to pay for this stuff? We're already in debt.
Yeah, well, my response was going to be she needs to keep promising those things. So it was a great question. Along with what Austin's saying, I think when this tax credit for first-time homeowners, when you talk about lowering the cost of prescription drugs, when you talk about all these things that are just everyday things that people can really say, yo, that would really help my life, that activates young voters. It activates minority voters. It activates Black men, a segment that they are struggling with right now, because all those margins really matter in a place like Pennsylvania. So that's one way. I think you got to keep hitting those notes of what you're going to offer in this opportunity agenda. I know a lot of people, they hear that $25K for first-time home buyers, that my age group, they're like, that sounds amazing.
Yeah. The cost of that house is going to go up $25,000. Is going to go up $24,000, by the way.
Of course. There's going to be impacts and effects, but we love candy. Everybody loves.
Yeah, and one can make the point that one of the reasons we had such high inflation is because there was so much money pumped into the economy during COVID relief, excess money pumped into the economy. And that's why we saw this, inflation up at around 9%. I've read about some of these plans of Harris's that, you give all this money and tax breaks. And the question does come up is like, are these going to be inflationary and where's the money going to come from to pay for it? John, you and I were talking on the radio the other day, and I voiced an objection to this debate rule that they can't ask each other questions. I think that that is how people argue in this life. They will say, well, Kate, you just said this, but what about this? Instead of me turning to John and say, ask Kate what she, it's like it seems to me to be just absolutely wrongheaded to say you can't turn to your opponent and ask a question. Why would that be off the table? I don't understand that, because it would also give the candidates less chance to complain about the moderators, to say, well, they didn't ask this question. If you can turn to your opponent and say, hey, if Trump had turned to Harris and said, this all sounds good, but it is candy, as Brandon said, and where does the money come from? That's a really good, urgent, relevant question. If he had been able to turn to her and ask about, what limits she supports on abortion, that's a relevant question. People want to hear the answer to that.
She throws up on that too, didn't she? I thought, oh gosh, what is the answer to? Would you allow it in the 7th or 8th month? And then I thought later on, she could have anticipated that and simply said, well, first of all, 99% of the time, that's not when it happens. And it's up to the woman and the doctor. The federal government shouldn't have a rule about this. So yes, I would allow it if the woman and the doctor feel that it is medically necessary.
And let's face it, those real late-term abortions are almost always, in fact, I think always the results of very serious complications, either in the pregnancy or with the fetus. They are not done frivolously at all. It's not like someone goes, oh, I want to fit into my prom dress. I'm going to get an abortion of a viable fetus. That kind of thing just doesn't happen. And using that it's like talking about immigrants eating dogs. It just doesn't happen. Or if it happens, it happened once or something. Yeah. So it's a question you have to learn how to parry if you're a political candidate. You have to learn how to address it.
You were saying before that, that I want to see more policy talk. What I want is for her to address the swing state voters who want to hear her differentiate herself on policy issues like abortion, where they think that she's too progressive. So really the majority of the country, even religious people, do support abortion with reasonable restrictions. But there are going to be swing state voters who are concerned that, you know, they think that there are a lot of pro-choice people out there who, you know, are willing to go right up to the day before birth with an abortion. So she could have easily differentiated herself right there by saying, yes, of course, I don't want to see seventh and eighth month abortions unless it is to save the life and health of the mother. Almost nobody disagrees with that. I don't think anyone disagrees with that.
This is the Mincing Rascals, and there's one other area we want to get to. But first, let me get you to Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. Surrounded by open spaces, rivers, and trails, Ottawa's a natural setting. It allows you to get outdoors and enjoy some fall relaxation. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Established hotels, resorts, private rentals, B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, now back to the Mincing Rascals. I want to ask you guys about one big issue in Chicago this week. But as we wrap this conversation up about the debates, I took some heat from family, friends, and listeners today when I said that I thought that the show and the moderators were favorable to Kamala Harris. I don't think that's going out on a skinny limb. Did you guys see or hear it that way, Eric? Did you think that they were right down the middle neutral, or do you think that they were more favorable? That's the word I keep using, to Kamala.
I thought that they gave Trump as much time as he needed to answer the questions that were thrown to him. They let him follow up in times when the rules did not call for him to follow up. They tried to move on. The only time they ever moved a candidate on was when Harris tried to answer a question. She asked if she could respond, and they just didn't let her. But in general, I think they probably were emotionally on Harris's side. But the truth is that Trump lies and distorts and misleads much more than Harris does. And if you're a moderator, you have to, I think it's on you to call out some of those really egregious facts. They probably should have called out Harris when she said that, you know, Trump left them with a certain, I think she said, unemployment rate, things like that. I mean, there were some moments where Harris did really fudge the truth on Trump, and they should have called her on that. So I would say mildly, yes, I think that they were, but not grossly.
Overall, yeah, they favored Kamala a little bit. You know, I heard some people saying that the anchors were hostile, that their questioning was hostile. And I didn't think so at all. I mean, like David Muir, and I think Lindsay Davis too, had to come back at Trump several times to try and get him to answer a specific question. But they never did it in a hostile way. I do think they could have asked her much harder questions. I think the main question I would have asked, and I really would have expected that they should have asked, was, this is an unusual situation that you are even here. You know, how do you explain the fact that you were defending President Biden up until the very last minute, claiming that he was 100% ready to run for president and serve as president for another 4 years, right up until the day he dropped out, and everybody knew what you were saying was demonstrably false? That's a fair question. They didn't ask that.
I think they needed to ask more policy questions for both of them. They did ask Trump, what does this mass deportation look like? Which is a very urgent question. He's talking about mass deportation and utilizing the National Guard, maybe the military, local police. And are they going to go door to door, haul people out, ask for their papers? And he said it's going to be bloody at one point recently. What does that look like? I think they needed to ask Harris things about immigration. Like, okay, we still have this problem at the border. How are you going to be different from Joe Biden? How are we going to make sure our borders are reasonably secure? What's your answer to that? I mean, I do think that some of this policy stuff is important, and maybe a second debate would be a good chance to air that out. But again, I really think that the Harris campaign is going to look deep at those polls and those crosstabs to see if there are voters that are not yet convinced but are reachable. Because there's a huge core of voters on both sides who are just not going to change their mind. even after that awful debate, Biden still, his support was still in the 40s, I think. It was in the low 40s. But he was, you still have a nut of people who saw that dreadful debate performance and said, I'm still with this guy. And you know that there's a similar, if not larger, percentage of Trump supporters who saw that dreadful debate performance of his on Tuesday night and are still with him. So how many voters are out there that they can still reach, that still are leaning one way or the other, but are persuadable? And they may not find that there are enough of them to risk another debate. I mean, you have a huge gaffe or something happens that's terrible during a debate. You might just want to play the hand that you've been dealt.
I thought that last question that they asked about Kamala Harris's racial identity and what Donald Trump said about it at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention here in Chicago was a dumb question. It was just teeing it up for Kamala to go ahead and run down the litany of racist remarks and positions that Donald Trump has taken. And it, to me, that was, and I only bring that up now because I think that lends itself to the notion that they were on Team Harris. I was cheering for a lot of the things that I heard on the TV last night because I finally wanted somebody to say that stuff. And you got a chance to hear it last night. But I thought it was to the advantage of Kamala Harris for that question to be asked. Essentially it was, hey, Donald Trump, are you a racist? And then he said, no, I'm not a racist. And then she said, he's a racist. And I thought, what was the value of that whole exchange? But they did that last night, too. And I think that was tailor-made for her, a black woman who knew what she was going to say.
That whole question is just a great example of why the National Association of Black Journalists was so right to do actual journalism at their convention and have their interview with Trump. That is a gift that is just kept on giving Kamala Harris. Although I understand it was a problem for you, Brandon. Sorry about that. But it was good for her, I think.
I don't think, Brandon, it wasn't a problem for you, was it? You're the president of the local chapter.
A lot of pressure.
I won't get into the intricacies, but I will say on the debate question itself, I think it was a great debate question. I think it's a worthy one because I don't think there's any doubt that Donald Trump, more than any other candidate for president probably since the Civil War, has made white identity and white supremacy a core element of his run and ascension in political life. And uses race to divide and continues to. I do think it is still on the top of mind of quite a few voters that this guy says some racist stuff and we just let it go. And so I thought it was a great moment to remind people what he said. Past statements do reflect values and his values don't seem to change. So I thought it was a worthy question. Were the moderators pro Kamala? I don't think they were pro Kamala in a sense. I think anyone's going to be interpreted as pro Kamala on a stage where you're actually fact checking.
That's what Eric said. Yeah.
And the most is Donald Trump. So if the CNN debate, if they actually fact checked the way they should have, they would have said Dana Bash and Jake Tapper were also pro Joe Biden.
Austin, can we just take 5 minutes here? I know we've gone long, but I wanted to hear you out on the story that just kind of broke before we came into our studios to record this podcast today. And that is what a top aide to the mayor has said about police. I have the Chicago Sun-Times headline in front of me. Three city council leaders demand ouster of top mayoral aide who called police effing pigs. You've read this story and you know maybe this story better than most of us do here. What can you tell us about that?
So over the weekend and in the previous couple weeks, there had been a lot of rumors that Mayor Brandon Johnson's deputy mayor of intergovernmental affairs, Sidney Holman, was going to resign. The deputy mayor of intergovernmental affairs is a very wordy way to say that's the mayor's top lobbyist. It's the person who coordinates getting things from the city council and whipping votes there, getting things from the Illinois General Assembly, getting things from the governor, getting things from the federal government. That all goes under the umbrella of intergovernmental affairs. It's a very, very important position. And Sidney Holman was in charge of that for Brandon Johnson. She previously worked for J.B. Pritzker, Tony Preckwinkle, on the Illinois House staff. So very important person in the administration, especially at a very, very critical time where Johnson is about to face his biggest challenge yet as mayor, which is addressing basically a billion-dollar deficit at the city level, $500 million to $1 billion deficit at the Chicago Public Schools. He's going to need a really, really talented government affairs staff to lobby city council for more revenue, lobby the state, lobby the feds. Like, it's a critical position. She resigned. News broke that she resigned on Monday. And the reason for the resignation, as reported by Marianne Ahern and others, is that under a restructuring of the mayor's office, Sidney Holman would be reporting to someone named Kennedy Bartley. Kennedy Bartley was the former executive director of a group called United Working Families that is really controlled by the Chicago Teachers Union. It's basically the Chicago Teachers Union controlling political spend from the CTU and the SEIU. And she was hired to a position in the mayor's office earlier this year, a newly created position as a liaison to progressive political groups. So Bartley is in the administration and is taking over a very, very important role. And rather than report to this person, Sidney Holman and three other women on her team all resigned. Then, after that news broke on Tuesday, news came out from Paris Schutz at Fox 32 of several interviews that Bartley had given in her past before taking this very important role in Johnson's administration. By way of background, she, before being at United Working Families, she was really the leader of the defund CPD movement. And in a 2021 interview, she said, quote, "If I die, especially at the hands of the pigs, don't name after me. I don't want a piece of legislation named after me or a road. I would be honored if that got more folks to abolition." So she's a prison and police abolitionist. And then she also talked about on another podcast, this previous podcast was in 2021. More recently this year, she was on a podcast saying, if we're talking about the budget, the time when every city department gets funded or defunded, this is the time when we make demands where we say, like, tax the rich, invest in communities, and defund the police. That has been a constant in the last 3 years of us engaging in the budget in this way. It's hard to talk about investments without talking about where we get the money from, and it's always CPD. So that news broke last night. And then today, finally, there are three city council leaders calling on Mayor Brandon Johnson to discipline or just fire Bartley completely. One is Alderman Brian Hopkins, who is the chair of the Public Safety Committee. One is Chris Taliaferro, who's the chair of the Police Committee. And one is Matt O'Shea, who's the chair of the Aviation Committee. And they're all basically saying, look, you cannot serve in this role in the mayor's office if you have fringe political views like this and are actively despising like a major city department. And I'll just close by saying, I think the resignation of Holman, and I don't think I'm saying this hyperbolically, and I've talked to a lot of people about this, I think could very well be the beginning of the end of Brandon Johnson's administration. Wow. It's a massive loss for him going into an extremely challenging period. And it shows that instead of trying to moderate and broaden his base and gain more support after winning the election with the narrowest margin in city history, he's doubling down on a very narrow activist base. That's what it signals. And that's why his approval rating is so low. And that's why nobody knows what's going to happen with this budget fight now.
Is that why Holman and these other people resigned rather than report to Bartley? Did they know that Kennedy Bartley was fringe or irritable or something? Why did they quit their jobs?
Yeah, I think it's a person who is really in a position of that's an operational position, being reporting to someone who is very much on the extreme radical and like proudly radical in the sense that like the activist base is radical in a proud way. Person from the CTU activist base of the left in Chicago. That is a very different approach to government. It's a very different working environment than someone who is just trying to focus on like how am I whipping votes in city council and how am I whipping votes in the General Assembly. So she did not want to report to that person.
When this story broke, it looked a little wonky to me. Like, well, that's the inner workings of City Hall. Who knows? Who cares? You think this is going to matter, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's palace intrigue, right?
Right.
I mean, these are like two jobs in our government, but it exemplifies a tension that is happening and that is just broken in the mayor's administration, which is he going to try to change course because what he's been doing over the past year, it's not been working and winning him support, or is he going to double down on the folks who funded his run? And he's doubling down.
It's interesting that Alderman Hopkins is one of the three who have come out already opposed to this, opposed to Bartley, and I can imagine more will be following. Hopkins is frequently cited as a potential challenger to Johnson in, when his term is up, his first term is up. And the ads will really just write themselves if he keeps her in place. That if he's going to change course, he's going to have to do it quickly. As Austin points out, when you have somebody who's using that kind of language and talking about abolishing police departments, I mean, the quote that you read, she says that they're a friend of abolition of police. And they're also people who are in favor of abolition of prisons. And those are fringe positions, let's be honest, and it won't be popular in many, many neighborhoods, including some of the neighborhoods that voted heavily for Brandon Johnson. So he's in a trick bag here. He's going to have to turn on his base, and he's in the same sort of trick bag with the CTU in negotiating this contract, because he doesn't have the money, his city doesn't have the money to pay them what they are asking for. And then we've also got the situation, and I don't know if you want to pivot to this quite yet, but ShotSpotter is going to be up. The contract begins to end on the 22nd of this month, on Sunday the 22nd. They're going to be phasing it out, despite the fact that both current and previous police commissioners or superintendents are in favor of it. And the most of the alders who are in the wards that are served by ShotSpotter want it there. And the police department has put out statistics talking about how much more quickly they respond to gunfire. And they find people who've been shot and no one has called 911. So you've got the situation, and the mayor is again doubling down on his answering to, I think, a small constituency of people who are strongly in his base, but his base is not big enough to sustain him politically.
It does relate to ShotSpotter in this way, which is you're going to have the mayor's office lobbying aldermen to say, hey, let us do what we want with ShotSpotter. And the lead person talking to the aldermen is someone who's on the record as wanting to abolish police and defund police. So you can't make a great argument. This is even, say, if you want to get rid of ShotSpotter, if you agree with 100% of Brandon Johnson's agenda, I think this is a bad idea to have this person in such a position of authority, because the city council members are just going to be saying, like, you don't care about what I think or my constituent. Yeah. You just want to abolish police and defund CPD. And you're all over the place saying it. And the way it's not only going to happen with ShotSpotter, the second place it's going to happen is in the city hiring freeze, which was just announced. So to get through the end of the year, Brandon Johnson has announced we're going to freeze hiring for the entire city. That includes police and that includes fire. If you're freezing hiring for police, that means there are people resigning that you are not replacing. And there's going to be city council members saying you are defunding police. And he tried to run away from this during the campaign. You all will remember that. It's going to come right back. And now he's going to have someone right next to him who is saying defund police as the head of his intergovernmental affairs. It's a big problem for him.
The whole situation is such another example of Brandon Johnson creating problems for himself. It reminds me, first, of how he just is consistently not communicating with people. ShotSpotter, also the perfect example. He didn't bother to communicate with the alderman. He just all of a sudden said, that's it. In addition, it reminds me of the wonderful WBEZ article that came out at Johnson's one-year anniversary about his basic management and job fulfillment. If you recall, it showed that half of his closest people, something like the inner 18 or 20 people,
right,
no experience in government whatsoever. And he had no administrative structure at that time. After a year in office, he could not give them
no org chart
to That's show.
Right. Yeah, right.
Which is nuts.
It continues a pattern for progressives in the city of Chicago during this period. Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor said maybe last year that she felt like progressives were not ready to lead, that they maybe had too much dip on their chip, as some would say. And you see things like this, things that, you know, come down to basic vetting, and it just continues that pattern. So, yeah, this is not good for the Johnson administration. This is not good for the city. And anytime you have someone talking about abolishing police or calling police pigs or things like that, that's not unifying language. And it's not language that's going to work in a city like Chicago, or really, I don't think any major city in America, right? So I think you'd have to consider what these calls are and pull the plug. It's just, there's no place for
it. Yeah, that might be an embarrassing move, but it might be the only one. And that's it for today. By the way, next week, you'll be entertained by a host named Eric Zorn, who will lead the conversation.
Get ready for gotcha questions. I'm going to find lots of follow-ups. And I'm going to keep track of who talks how much.
Well, we've talked a lot here today. I appreciate Austin and Brandon, Kate and Eric. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop another Mincing Rascals podcast on you without me next week. Ta-da!
John, did I hear you make a Dr. Strangelove allusion this morning?
One of my all-time favorite movies, yeah.
Yeah.
You too?
No time, no inclination for strategic thought.
Well, I've been to one World's Fair, a picnic, and a rodeo, and that's the stupidest thing I ever heard come over a set of headphones. There's other great lines in that movie, but boy, that's...
All these people surprised that Darth Vader was in Dr. Strangelove, and I was like, of course he was!
He was in the back of the plane! Come on!
He sticks his head up and asked it, do you think this is a test?
Nice.
Mm. Well, have a good trip, John.
Yeah, no, we plan to. Thanks, Kate.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.